I don't know why a guy like me has taken 5.5 years to get to a sermon like this, given the fact that, I pretty much carry a gun with me everywhere I go and have for years and years. But I want to talk tonight about gun rights and self-defense. I guess better late than never. And I will just give you a brief overview of what I'm going to cover tonight before we get into it. So first of all, I want to talk about how self-defense is a God-given right, and we want to look at the Bible and see how the Bible, God in the Bible, gives us this right of self-defense. And then I want to look at how self-defense is a natural right. So we could just reason, just using our pure reasoning capabilities, and deduce that we have the right of self-defense. We have the right to own guns, and we can figure that out, like I said, just by reasoning. And then I want to talk about how guns are the modern day equivalent of swords in the Bible, and then that kind of opens up some things for us. And then I want to talk about some self-defense tips. I've been subscribed to a YouTube channel called Active Self-Protection. It's the guy that does it is actually a former preacher, and it's a I recommend anybody that's interested in the topic subscribe to his channel. He puts out a video every day, and what it is it's usually a surveillance video. Of and anywhere all over the world, and it's some type of a self-defense encounter, whether it's with a gun or a knife or empty-handed skills or something. And sometimes the good guy wins and sometimes the good guy loses, and you get to learn a lot of stuff. So a lot of the things that I'm going to be talking about in that section I got from him. And then the interesting thing was, as I was just remembering the things that I learned from him and jotting them down, and then I started thinking about, oh, I could use a Bible verse to prove that. I could use a Bible verse to prove that. So a lot of the things that he teaches are, the principles are certainly found in the scripture. Then I want to talk about how gun-free zones are murder zones, give you some statistics on that. I want to talk about how guns save lives, like hundreds of thousands of lives every year. And I want to talk about how gun control is wicked and is a tool of wicked governments that they've used to massacre millions and millions of people over the last century. And then lastly, we want to talk about the Second Amendment, and we want to talk about what it is for. And it's not for deer hunting, and it's not for target shooting. It is to have an armed populace to resist tyranny. It's to protect yourself from your own government, basically, is what it is. And I have quotes from the Founding Fathers which will show us that. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about how self-defense is a God-given right and a duty. We're going to first go to what Jesus taught in Luke 11 and verse 21. So Jesus was teaching here, and he uses a principle of self-defense as a given. It's just this is just a something that he makes reference to that everybody should already know. Like it's not even something that he's teaching per se. He's just referencing something that is a given. And that is that a strong man would protect his house with arms. So Luke 11 and verse 21 says, "When a strong man armed keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. But when a stronger than he shall come upon him and overcome him, he taketh from him all his armor wherein he trusted and divideth his spoils." So Jesus said there, when a strong man armed keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. Armed means furnished with arms or armor, fully equipped for war. That's the primary definition. An arm is a defensive or an offensive outfit for war, things used in fighting. So to be armed, which means fully equipped for war, to be armed today, one must have a semi-automatic rifle, such as an AR-15, right? If you're going to be armed for war, right, then that's what you need. You need to have a battle weapon, basically. And that would be an AR-15 or any semi-automatic rifle, a AK-47 or a Mini 14 or any number of weapons like that. So I would say, therefore, a Christian is well within his God-given rights to have an AR-15 to defend his home and his family. And I don't want to get off chasing too many rabbits, but an AR-15 is not an assault weapon. People refer to them as assault weapons. An assault weapon would be a military-grade, fully automatic weapon. An AR-15 is not. It's a semi-automatic, which means that every time you pull the trigger, a bullet comes out. Fully automatic means you hold the trigger down and a whole bunch of bullets come out. So anyway, AR-15 is, I think, or one like it is the weapon of choice, because that's a weapon that you could really defend your home with against invaders, or you could, God forbid, defend yourself against roving bands of horde hoarders, or not hoarders, but hordes of people that are, of looters and things like that. So I highly recommend it. I think that Christians, or Christian men at least, ought to have at least two things in their home: a King James Bible and an AR-15. That's my personal opinion. If you don't agree with that, get the King James Bible, of course. But you don't have to get the AR-15 if you don't want to. But I think that every person should have one personally. Now, Jesus also taught that a good man of a house would not suffer or allow a thief to break into his house. Matthew 24 and verse 43. But notice in that previous verse that we looked at, just the principle that Jesus makes reference to. A strong man armed with a weapon of defense will not suffer his house to be broken into. He's not going to allow, somebody to come in and steal his stuff. And that's just a principle that Jesus refers to. It's not even so much that he had to say, hey, go get yourself a weapon. He's just saying, hey, I'm going to prove my point by just making reference to the fact that any man worth his salt has a weapon and would defend his home and not allow somebody to come in and to rob him while he's there. Matthew 24 and verse 43. Jesus said, but know this, that if the good men of the house had known in what hour, in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. This is, he's talking about in reference to the second coming, that he will come as a thief in the night, and he's telling his disciples to watch. And then he uses another example, the good men of the house. A good man is, sometimes used as a vague title of dignity and respectful form of address. But then it's also a master or male head of a household or other establishment, the host of an inn, the keeper of a prison. So the good man is basically the master of the house, the husband, right? And Jesus says, by way of example, that if the good man, if the master of the house would know when a thief is coming, he would not suffer or allow the thief to break into his home, right? How do you not allow a thief to break into your home? Well, you stop him, right? You defend yourself with some type of a weapon of self-defense. So the male head of a household is therefore responsible to prevent thieves and other attackers from entering his house by whatever means necessary, because Jesus said he would not suffer, which means to allow. So whatever it takes, you do not allow somebody to break into your home when you're there. I mean, if you're not there, obviously you can't stop it. But when you're there, you don't allow somebody to break into your home and to rob you. And you can use anything up into lethal force to repel that invasion. Today, this requires that a good man have a gun in his house that's loaded, or at least it could be very quickly, and easily accessible in the event of a surprise break-in. Because if you have guns, but they're locked up in a safe somewhere, all of them are, what good are they going to be to you? And they're pretty well absolutely useless in the event of a break-in. You couldn't possibly, maybe, I guess if you had the electronic push code and the safe was right in your bedroom, it'd be pretty darn hard, though, to get into it in the event of a break-in. So you can keep some of your guns in the locked up, but I think everybody ought at least have one that's not locked up, that's somewhere accessible, that's either loaded or has a clip right next to it or something where it could be loaded very quickly and ready to go. If you got little kids or something, you could put it where they can't get a hold of it, or you could just do what my dad did. We had guns all over the house, ammo all over the house, and we just didn't touch them. You just don't touch them. You don't play with them. And there would have been heck to pay if we would have, right? So I don't know. I'm not telling people what to do, but it certainly worked out in our home to have guns and ammo all over the place with little kids, and there was never a problem. So these verses prove that armed self-defense is just a given in Scripture, right? That's the way it was back then. It's the way it should be today. It was the way it was under the Law of Moses, too. In the Law of Moses, you could kill an intruder in your home at night and be faultless. Look at Exodus 22 and verse 2. I've never been broken into before, but I can just imagine how terrifying of an experience that would be. If you're in your house and you hear the front door get kicked in or something, like I would defend any man's right to kill somebody that entered their house. You're in their house, you deserve to die. I mean, I can't imagine the terror that would incite in somebody. and I would defend anybody's right to kill somebody that's in their house. Exodus 22 and verse 2. If a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. So if the thief is breaking up or breaking in to the house, and the man goes and defends himself and his family and kills the thief, no blood shed for him. In other words, he's free, right? He did not commit a sin or a breach of the law in doing that. Now, I would say since Jesus Christ affirmed that principle in the verses that we just read, right, then the principle still stands in the New Testament, and a Christian is fully justified in killing a man if he's broken into his house at night. My brother, just lucky he didn't get killed one time in my dad's house, because I think this was after he was out of high school by this time, but he would still come back and stay. I don't know if he was staying with my dad. I think maybe he was working on the road or something, but he would come back, and that was kind of his home base still. And he comes home one night, way middle of the night, after midnight, and just comes walking in and didn't think much of it. And he's in the refrigerator getting something. He closes the door. Whoa! And my dad's sitting there pointing a gun at him, because my dad didn't know who it was. He just heard somebody rummaging around in the house, and lucky he didn't get killed. But anyway, I guess if you're going to shoot somebody in your house, maybe make sure, like, at least a split second that it's not, like, your child or something like that. But, and this is where the law called the Castle Doctrine, this is where this comes from, I think, anyway, because this is basically, this is God's Castle Doctrine. Somebody breaks into your house at night, you don't have to retreat, you don't have to prove that you tried to talk the man out of his... you know, intent to murder you or anything, you can just kill him, and you're fully justified in doing so. Third point from the scripture, which would give us the right of self-defense, is what Paul taught in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. Now, this one you have to do just a little bit of reasoning, but not much. We're just going to reason from the lesser to the greater, and it'll be easy to see. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. It says, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith, and is worse than an infidel. Now the provision here, excuse me, in this case is material provision, providing for their food and clothing and shelter and that kind of thing. Okay, so that's true. So if a man is considered it worse than an infidel for not providing for his family materially, how much more so if he doesn't provide for their basic life and security, right? To provide for the protection of their life or their health. So therefore, if a man doesn't have a gun, or at least a self-defense weapon of some kind to use to protect, to provide and protection for his family, then I'd say he's worse than an infidel. Because like I said, we're reasoning from the lesser to the greater. If you don't provide him with food and clothing, you're worse than an infidel. If you don't stop them from being murdered, how much more worse than an infidel are you? So that means that every man ought to be able to protect his family. And, I mean, obviously a gun's the best tool, but maybe if you want to have another self-defense weapon, a baseball bat or something in your home to protect against invaders, you ought to at least have something. All right, number four. Abraham used armed men to rescue his nephew Lot. Genesis 14. Remember, Abraham is the man of faith. And here's what the faithful man Abraham did whenever his nephew Lot got taken over by some of these kings that had attacked Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 14 through 16. See, it's interesting here if you think about it. This is another side note, and I don't have time for many rabbits. But Sodom and Gomorrah is known for sodomy, right? And Sodom and Gomorrah gets taken over by some nations that were being belligerent towards them. So they have Sodom and Gomorrah have a military which had sodomites in it, and they get taken over by a foreign power. Think about it. What is our military now, right? They openly allow sodomites, transgenders, all these other weirdos, and women on the front lines, and just crazy things. How long before we're not going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah and being taken over by somebody else? And rightly so. Anyway, Genesis 14, 14 through 16. It says, and when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, talking about Lot, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them to Hobah, unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. So there were nations that went up against Sodom and Gomorrah and took Lot captive, and Abraham takes 318 trained servants and goes and whoops up on these armies and brings back Lot and all of his goods. Now those guys, obviously, that was not the first time they picked up a gun. Now of course they didn't have guns, they had swords or spears or whatever, but it wasn't the first time they picked up a sword or a spear. They were trained, they were ready. So I say every man should have a gun and know how to use a gun in case of an emergency. The more training, the better, but at least know how to use it and be comfortable with it. Number five, there was a man named Abner, and he defended himself against a guy named Asahel in 2 Samuel 2:18-23. And this is a valuable passage to us because this will teach us something about the principle of self-defense. Because you have the right to defend yourself, but you don't have the right to aggress upon somebody else, and you don't have the right to use disproportionate force against somebody. If some guy walks up to you and say, you know, and they're standing 20 feet away, and they say, you know what, I'm going to come up and clock you in the head, you just can't pull out a gun and kill them, right? You can't use disproportional force. You can say, well, stay away from me, and if he starts coming closer to you, then if you fear for your life, then you could, you know, you could take out a weapon if you feared for your life, but you still can't kill him until there's an imminent deadly threat there. And this is what happened with Abner. In 2 Samuel 2, verses 18 through 20, no, yeah, 2 Samuel 2, 18 through 23, Abner acted lawfully here, and he gave Asahel a couple of chances. 2 Samuel 2 and verse 18. It says, and there were three sons of Zeruiah there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel, Asahel, I think that's how it's pronounced. Asahel was as light of foot as a wild roe. So he's a dangerous man. I mean, this guy, a wild roe, a wild deer, he's quick on his feet. You get somebody like this coming at you, you want to beware because he's a dangerous man. And Asahel pursued after Abner, and in going he turned not to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. So Abner's trying to get away from him, and Asahel is on his tail. And Abner keeps turning around and says, hey, back off, buddy. Then Abner looked behind him and said, art thou Asahel? And he answered, I am. And Abner said unto him, turn thee aside to thy right hand or to thy left, and lay thee hold on one of the young men, and take thee his armor. But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, second warning, turn thee aside from following me. Wherefore should I smite thee to the ground? How then should I hold up my face to Joab, thy brother? So this guy's following him. He's in fear for his life. He tells him, hey, back off. Go a different way. He doesn't listen. He tells him, I'm telling you, back off. Why should I have to kill you? So he's giving him a threat of deadly force. If you keep pursuing me, I'm going to have to kill you, right? So he has done everything that he can. But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. End of verse 21. Verse 22. And Abner said again. Okay, so we already read verse 22. Verse 23. Howbeit he refused to turn aside. Wherefore Abner with the hinder end of his spear smote him under the fifth rib, that the spear came out behind him, and he fell down there and died in the same place. And it came to pass that as many as came to the place where Asahel fell down and died stood still. So he warned him twice, and then he killed him. And it said he used the hinder part of his spear, and I don't know if he was running away and he stabbed him backwards, kind of a surprise attack. I don't know exactly how that worked, but anyway, the point is, he warned him twice and he killed him. And he was obviously he was concerned about his own life. And he was justified in killing him in self-defense. And the same principle holds true with us today. If an attacker who has the ability and the intent to do a man serious bodily harm continues to move closer to a man when he has a gun drawn and is telling him to stop, then the man has the right to kill him in self-defense. So in that case, I mean, if some guy, you're walking down the street and some guy walks up to you and he pulls out a knife and he says, you know, give me your wallet, and you pull out a gun and say, hey, back off, and the guy starts walking towards you or something, kill him. You can shoot him, right? And even if some guy is coming at you, I mean, if he's a big guy, and I mean, I guess maybe you want to get legal advice on this, but I would say if he's a big guy, clearly a dangerous person, and like a small guy like me, and then he could just pummel me with his fist and kill me, I mean, if you tell him to stop, don't get any closer to me, and he keeps coming and keeps coming, you'd be within your rights to shoot him. Because if in your mind you're fearing for your life, you can do just like Abner did. At least is my understanding. So every man needs to make his own determination in that, but that would be my determination. Just know if you do kill a man in self-defense, beware that his family or friends could exact revenge on you, as did Joab to Abner. And Abner ended up dying for this, and poor Abner didn't do anything wrong, and Joab was guilty of murder. In 2 Samuel 3 and verse 27, and when Abner was returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him quietly. Like he's, hey, I got something to tell you, Abner. And smote him under the fifth rib, that he died for the blood of Asahel his brother. So remember, Abner was concerned about Joab anyway. He said, you know, how am I going to hold up my face to Joab thy brother if he ends up killing him? And that's exactly what happened. He didn't end up being able to hold up himself in front of Joab. Joab stealthily killed him. And this is what, sort of what the cities of refuge were for in Israel. Not exactly, because in Israel, if you accidentally killed somebody, you could go to the city of refuge and be protected from the revenger of blood, excuse me. Like if a family member was upset that you were chopping wood and the head of the axe fell off and clobbered some guy in the head and killed him, if the family was upset about that, they could come and kill you if you didn't make it to the city of refuge. And I guess maybe Abner should have ran over to the city of refuge and maybe he could have got protected from Joab. All right, number six. If we see another person being physically assaulted, we are obligated to help him if we can. So we're not only allowed and we have a duty to defend ourselves, but we also have a duty to defend those that can't defend themselves if we have the ability to do so. Proverbs 24, 11 through 12. If thou forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death, and those that are ready to be slain, if thou sayest, behold, we knew it not, doth not he that pondereth the heart consider it? And he that keepeth thy soul, doth not he know it? And shall not he render to every man according to his works? So God says, if you see somebody drawn off to death, if you see some guy grabbing a young lady and pulling her into a van or something, and you do nothing about it, and you could, you're in trouble with God, because God says, don't say I didn't know it. Oh, I didn't see it. And I'll tell you what, that's why I think everybody should be prepared to defend yourself and realize that nobody is coming to help you in today's day and age, because generally speaking, people do not help anymore. I've seen lots of videos where on this YouTube channel where people are just getting, I mean, this guy at a bar was just getting pummeled by somebody else. Surprise attack, went up and punched him right, sucker punch, and just pummeling him. And these dopes at the bar just sitting there just looking at it. Like, didn't even stop the guy. Like, I think that's why you ought to carry a gun and be ready to defend yourself, because chances are bystanders are just going to stand and watch you get killed or accosted or something. It's pitiful.
What was in the Mall of Minnesota? You did an early on video. Was that a mayor?
He was some type of a political figure in Minneapolis. I don't remember what he was, yeah. But yeah, he was accosted by this, I think it was a woman that, was it a woman? I think she stole his cell phone or something, and he went to, I don't remember the deal. I think it had to do with his cell phone getting stolen, and he went to try to get it, and somebody just beat the tar out of him. I think it was a woman, actually. And everybody just stood around. Nobody did anything. Nobody even helped the guy. And now it's one. I mean, if you're a woman, you don't jump in to help. And if it's some huge 300-pound dude beating the tar out of some other guy, a guy like me, honestly, I'm probably not going to jump in because I'm going to get killed or something, and I have a responsibility to my own family. But if I have a gun or a force multiplier or something, and I could stop something like that, then you should. You want to put yourself in the victim's shoes and help if possible. So I say, since self-defense is a God-given right and duty, no man should ever give up his guns, because God gives you a right to have a weapon of self-defense, and we should never give up our guns, no matter what. I'm going to talk about that at the very end of the study as well. I added in one other point, because I was thinking about this afternoon, where some people will say, you know, God will just protect me. I'm not worried about it. I don't need a gun. I don't need to know how to shoot a gun. God will just protect me. I'm just going to trust in him. Well, remember what Proverbs 21:31 says. Yeah, it's good to trust in the Lord, but you better trust and prepare. Because if you haven't prepared and you're just going to trust in the Lord, you know, might not be so quick to help you. It says, the horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. But the horse still has to be prepared. The Lord provides the safety, but you know sometimes what he provides the safety through? The horse, right? It's like the guy, you've heard the story, the guy was, you know, his house is being flooded, and he crawls up on the porch, and the guy comes by in a boat, and he says, hey, jump in the boat. No, no, the Lord's going to save me. And whatever. And the guy, you know, goes off in the boat, and then the water gets higher, and he climbs up on top of the roof, and he's standing on the roof, and a guy comes by in a helicopter, and he says, hey, he throws him a rope. Hey, grab on here. Let me save you. The water's getting higher. No, 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 the Lord's going to save me. The Lord's going to protect me. And then I think there was a third guy. I don't remember. And then the guy finally, the flood takes him away, and he dies, and he gets to heaven, and the guy says, Lord, I thought you were going to protect me. He's like, I sent you a boat. I sent you a helicopter. What more do I need to do, right? So the Lord helps those that help themselves. That's not a verse in the Bible, but it is nevertheless true. I think a lot of people think that's a verse. But anyway, you got to prepare the horse and then trust in the Lord. Why not just simply trust in God? Well, I don't know. Why lock your doors at night, right? Just trust God. Nothing's going to happen, right? Why have a fire extinguisher in your house? Just trust the Lord. It's not going to burn down, right? Why have health insurance or car insurance or home insurance? Just trust the Lord, right? Why save for retirement? Well, the Lord will provide. You know, whenever I get old, somebody's just going to come by and throw a pile of money on my front porch or something, right? Yeah, could the Lord do that? Of course. Could he prevent your house from burning down? Yes. Could he prevent you from ever having an accident in your car? Yes, of course he could. Could he prevent a thief from ever coming to your house and checking to see if your door is locked? Yes, he could. But he also gives you a brain and tells you to make provision for yourself and take care of yourself. Okay, now self-defense is not only a biblical right. It's not only a right from God, but you could argue it's just a natural right that somebody, an atheist, could come to this persuasion just by reasoning. So from the standpoint of nature, human beings have a right to defend themselves. And the reasoning would go like this. Human beings own themselves. Now, I know we're all owned by God, but I'm talking about, as far as human beings go, I own myself. None of you own me. Well, my wife kind of, she does own my body, the Bible says. But you know what I'm saying, right? So every person owns themselves. No other person has a greater claim on my body than me, right? I have a better claim on my body than anybody else, right? I can do what I want. Nobody has the right to force me to do something I don't want to do, right? Unless you know, I'm in debt and I owe them or something like that. But in general, people can't force you to do something you don't want to do. No human being has the right to kill or kidnap or physically harm another human being, right? Because he would be aggressing upon that person, and that person has a right to his body and to his health and to not be molested. So therefore, every person has the right to defend himself against the aggressions of others. Because if I own my body, I have a right to protect my body against somebody else trying to harm my body, because they don't own it. I own it. It's mine, right? Now, from the standpoint of nature, human beings have the right to own weapons as well. You just think about it. If a man digs iron ore out of the ground that he owns, right? And then he takes that iron ore and he melts it down and he forms it into a knife or a gun. No man has a right to confiscate that or destroy it, right? It's my land. I dug in the ground. I mined out the iron. I formed that iron into a gun or a knife. No other man has the right to come by and say, hey, give me that gun, right? I made it. It's mine. It's my land. You say, well, how'd you get the land? The principle of homesteading, right? You go and you mix your labor with an unclaimed piece of land, and therefore that land becomes yours because you have a greater claim on it than anybody else does. John Locke came up with that, you know, 400 years ago. Nor does any man have the right to prohibit that man, the man that made the weapon, from carrying his weapon on his own land or on the land of others who have given him permission to do so. Now, somebody could prevent me from carrying my weapon on their land. If they don't want me to carry my weapon on their land, they can say, you're not coming on my land with that weapon. They're totally within their rights. But nobody has the right to tell me that I can't carry my weapon on my land, right? I can do whatever I want on my land. And nobody has the right to tell me that I can't carry my weapon on somebody else's land who has given me permission to carry my weapon on their land, right? Nor does any man have the right to prohibit the owner of the weapon from selling it to another man. I mined out the iron. I made this weapon. I therefore can sell it to somebody else if I want to, and no other man has the right to tell me I can't sell something that I own lawfully, right? So since human beings have the natural right to defend themselves, which we already saw because they own their own bodies, and since they have the natural right to produce, possess, and sell weapons, they also have the natural right to defend themselves with those weapons, right? So you can reason that out without even having the Bible. But of course, the Bible proves it irrefutably, and I like the biblical argument way better than the natural argument, but you can reason that out yourself as well. Okay, now, what about guns? Because in the Bible there were no guns, and yet the Bible gives us the duty and the right of self-defense. So let's look in the Bible and see what the self-defense weapon was at the time, and you can see that in Luke 22 and verse 36. Luke 22 and verse 36. I should have brought a prop with me by way of illustration, because I have a Glock 36 that I had engraved with Luke 22, 36, which says, he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. I could have, you know, showed you a practical application of this verse, but anyway, Luke 22 and verse 36. It says, then said he unto them, but now he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, which is a bag, and he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. So Jesus is sending out his disciples into the world. And he said when he sent them out before, they didn't have to worry about taking purse or scrip or shoes or anything. Everything was going to be taken care of. But now, he says, if you have, how did he say it? If you have a purse, take it with you. You got a bag, take it with you. And if you don't have a sword, go sell something and get one. Because now I'm sending you out into a dangerous world. You read about Paul in perils of his own countrymen, in perils of robbers, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the city. It's a dangerous place out there. Get yourself a weapon of self-defense, Jesus is teaching them. If they could not afford one, they were to sell other things in order to buy one. This is how important it is to have a weapon of self-defense, that you'd sell something else that you have to buy it if you don't have one. Now, they produced two swords, as Jesus was speaking in verse 38. It says, and they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, it is enough. So they produced two swords. So this obviously means that they were carrying them on their person, right? Because they were out somewhere. I don't know if they were, if this was in the Garden of Gethsemane, I don't remember. But anyway, they were out. I mean, they obviously weren't sitting at their house or something like that. And two of them have swords on them. So they were carrying self-defense weapons. Notice Jesus did not chastise them for doing so, which demands that they were carrying deadly weapons is permissible for a Christian. They're carrying deadly weapons. These are swords. These are Roman swords. A Roman sword was the self-defense weapon of the day. It was a military-type weapon. Jesus did not say, I meant spiritual sword, guys. Right, because that's what some people think. Oh, they try to spiritualize this, like he's talking about, you know, carrying the scripture with you or something like that, because it's called the sword of the spirit. He didn't say, no, well, put those things away. You know, I was talking about the Bible. No, he was talking about a physical, actual sword. He said two swords among them was enough. So if at least a couple of the men in the church are carrying a concealed weapon, then it should be enough to protect the church, right? Two are enough. I mean, there was a time in my life, back when I was a little more radical than I am now, I would carry two self-defense guns on me just for the fun of it. And it was fun. And my friend and I, we would each carry two. This is when we were in college, and we would go over to another friend's house. He was off campus. And we'd be sitting there doing physics or calculus or whatever, and we'd be taking our handguns out. So we got a table full of handguns as we're doing our homework. And people would walk in the door and be like, whoa, what the heck's wrong with you guys? So anyway, now, you know, I guess in my old age, I've just kind of gotten lazy and I only carry one. But hopefully that's enough. But anyway, two is good. Like somebody said, if you don't have two, you don't have any. So every man should own a gun and be able to use it to protect his family. Like I said, a Roman sword, which Jesus instructed his disciples to acquire, was a combat weapon. Today's equivalent of the Roman sword is a semi-automatic rifle like an AR-15. I believe that every American should own one. I really do. I believe that every American, or at least every male American, should own an AR-15. And it's probably getting to the point where probably half of them do. I mean, that's a very popular weapon and a lot of people own them, which is great. The more the merrier. When you have a country that has like 300 million weapons, or 300 million guns in it, That's wonderful, because the chances of, number one, of the government taking them are very, very slim. I mean, you ain't going to take 300 million guns away from people. It just ain't going to happen, I don't think. I mean, they may make it harder and harder to get them and harder to get ammunition and all that, but they are not going door to door and taking guns. Not in this. I don't think so. I hope not. Not in this country. Other countries that don't have the tradition of firearms, yeah, they were able to disarm them, and I'll show you what happens after they do, but hopefully it never happens here. And I'd say if you can't afford an AR-15, sell one of your possessions and buy it. I think it's that important. I think every man should own an AR-15, and if he doesn't, sell something to buy it. It's worth it.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure, yeah.
I'm pretty sure there's no men in the building I live in that have an AR-15 or even a gun.
Mm-hmm.
There might be, but I seriously doubt it. The people in there are so liberal.
Oh, yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
And I have a revolver and a .22 rifle. Should I have an?
I mean, you certainly could. It's an easy gun for a woman to shoot. They don't kick.
Is it really?
Oh yeah, they don't. They barely kick at all.
Okay.
Yeah. When I was in the army, they used. I don't know if they did this with you, but some of the soldiers had never shot one before, and they look scary, so they're scared of them. And they would have you hold the thing. One of the drill sergeants would hold it right on his crotch and then shoot it. Just to show that it doesn't, I mean, it kicks a little bit, but nothing like a shotgun or a high-powered rifle or anything.
Uh-huh.
So, there's a funny video.
What size bullets, ammunition do they use?
It's a 5.56 millimeter or a 223. It's the caliber is not much bigger than a .22, but it's the cartridge is a lot, you know, has a lot more powder, a lot more power.
Is at 38.
Yep. And that's good. I mean, I think I don't think that you need to go out and buy an AR-15, you know. But a man defending his house, yeah, I think a man should have one, yeah. But, and once again, my opinion, right? You don't have to go out and buy an AR-15 if you don't want one. It's my opinion. I think everybody should have one. But if you don't want one, hey, we can still be friends.
I'm starting to feel like I need to go buy another one.
Yeah. Well, and if your neighbor doesn't have one, maybe you should have two just in case.
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah.
The 240 Bravo.
There you go, yeah.
Well, you have a wife that could use one, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so this is going to be an interesting part of the study, I think. I'm going to talk about some tips to remember regarding self-defense. Number one, pray that you never have to use your gun to defend yourself. Right? The object is not to kill somebody. The object is never... If you carry a gun every day of your life and you never, ever pull it out, thank God for it. You don't want to have to pull it out. Look at Matthew 6 and verse 13. So this is the first thing you should do in preparing to defend yourself, is pray that you never have to. Matthew 6 and verse 13, this is the Lord's Prayer, "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen." Lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil. And a self-defense encounter is evil. It's evil in the sense of dangerous, right? It's not evil for you to defend yourself, but it's evil like the Lord would send evil upon a people whenever he would have them be, you know, harmed and taken over. And I guess another thing, Bev, if you wanted to buy an AR-15, it'd be a good investment, I think, right? So if you got just some money laid up just for a rainy day or something, it would be a good investment to have. It's probably not going to lose its value, and more than likely it would increase in value, especially if you get some pinko commie in the White House, you know, someday that's very anti-gun or something. So, for nothing else, it might be something good to have in that regard. Okay, number two, avoid dangerous places at dangerous times. Proverbs 14:14-15. This is a mistake a lot of people do when they're armed. They think, oh, I've got a gun. I'll just go anywhere I want, anytime I want, and I'm not scared of anybody. Well, you should be. Proverbs 4:14-15. Enter not into the path of the wicked. Go not in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it and pass away. Don't go stupid places with stupid people at stupid times. Right? Chances are, if it's after midnight, you should be at home sleeping. I'm at home sleeping after 9. But if it's late at night, you probably shouldn't be out. And you shouldn't be out in a city or an urban area if it's late at night. Bad things are going to happen late at night. And especially don't be hanging out with idiots and drunks and people at partiers and things like that. Bad things can happen. Number 3, avoid bad people in general. Proverbs 13 and verse 20. The reason why I've never had to draw out my gun, probably one of the reasons, is I don't hang out with crowds of people where I'm going to have to, right? I hope I never do. I don't run with that crowd. But that doesn't mean that something bad couldn't happen. I mean, it can, but you can mitigate that by staying away from bad people. Proverbs 13 and verse 20, "He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed." A lot of these videos that I see on this YouTube channel, a lot of times things are happening late at night, right? And women Uber drivers driving around at 1 o'clock in the morning and bad things happening to them. It's crazy. Don't do that. Number 4, don't go anywhere with a gun that you would be afraid to go to without a gun. And that's a very good principle. So if you wouldn't walk down that dark alley in Kansas City without a gun, don't do it with a gun, right? If you wouldn't drive through Gary, Indiana at 10 o'clock at night, you know, if you've ever been to Gary with all the boarded up windows and bars and everything, if you wouldn't do that without a gun, don't go to Gary with a gun, right? Stay away from Gary, Indiana. I drove through that place accidentally one time at noon, and I didn't even want to stop at red lights. I just wanted to keep moving. I mean, that place is just scary looking. So yeah, don't think just because you have a gun you're invincible. Pay attention to your surroundings. Ephesians 5 and verse 15. This is very important. This is one thing I've learned on that from that YouTube channel, is just to pay attention, to be aware. Not be paranoid, but to be aware. Ephesians 5:15, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise." I'm kind of taking the principle from the verse more than anything. Circumspectly, looking around, paying attention, not as fools. When you come out of, I mean, even when I come out of my apartment, I'm coming out at before 5 o'clock in the morning, and, or no, a little after five, anyway, five something in the morning. And when I come out, there's windows on the side of the door on both sides, and I just kind of peek over when I'm walking outside, actually. I just kind of peek around, make sure nobody's standing there, and then walk out. And as I walk out, I just kind of look over my shoulder a little bit. I get in the car. First thing you do when you get in the car, lock the door. First thing you do when you get in the car, lock the door. Because somebody can easily, if they were waiting, they can easily just walk up, open that door, rip you out of the car or whatever. So get in there, lock the door. Especially if you have things to do and you're goofing around, looking on your phone or whatever you're doing, lock a door first. Just pay a little bit of attention. especially at night, if you're walking up to your car, just kind of look around, you know, just glance. If you're walking up between cars to get in your car, just kind of look in the window of the car beside you and make sure there's nobody in there or something. It's, like I said, not paranoid, just aware. Always try to avoid physical confrontation. Matthew 10 and verse 16. The idea is not to get into a fight, or especially a gunfight, but any kind of a fight. Try to avoid it. Matthew 10 and verse 16. Jesus said, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." Be wise, be paying attention, but then also be harmless. Don't be one that's going to try to start a fight. If you get involved in a confrontation, remain calm and try to talk the person down. Look at Proverbs 15 and verse 1. This is what this guy on the YouTube channel, his name is John Correa, he says, verbal judo. Try to talk the guy down. Talk him out of it. Don't. If you start acting belligerent, then it's just going to escalate and things are going to go from bad to worse. Proverbs 15 and verse 1 says, "A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger." So, you know, if you're out somewhere and some guy says, "Hey, you looking at my girlfriend?" I'm like, nope, nope. I mean, hopefully you weren't. But, you know, but anyway, nope. I don't want any trouble at all. Just back down. Don't say, "Hey, no, I wasn't. What are you talking about?" You know, don't start. Don't start a fight. Swallow your pride and your ego. This is one that I learned from this YouTube channel that I don't agree with, but that's not the way that I used to think, and I've changed my thinking on this one. Proverbs 16 and verse 18. Swallow your pride and your ego when it comes to an altercation like that, especially. It says, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." If you are proud and you don't want to lose face in front of somebody, and you're going to be a tough guy, that pride's going to go before destruction. Proverbs 14 and verse 16. "A wise man feareth and departeth from evil, but the fool rageth and is confident." The wise man sees the evil and says, "Nope, I'm not going there." The fool goes headstrong into it. And I'll tell you what I'm talking about. It's not worth getting killed to save your wallet. It's not. I used to think this, like when I would be walking or something back when I was single and I'd be walking around, and I always think, what if some guy came up with a knife, or what if this or what if that, and said, "Give me your wallet." And there was a time in my life when I thought, no way. I mean, I'd rather die than give him my wallet. Just for the principle of the matter, that punk is not going to take my wallet. But you know what? That's stupid. It is not worth dying over your wallet. Especially if you've got a family or anybody that's relying on you or people that love you. It is not worth dying over your wallet. It's not worth killing someone to save your car. Some guy's trying to steal your car. You don't shoot through the windshield as he's driving away. It is not worth killing somebody over a car, right? Let him have it. That's what you got insurance for. It would stink to lose your wallet. I mean, you lose all your, you know, your IDs and all that, and it'd be a pain in the butt to get it all back. But you know what? It's not that big of a deal. Just give it to him. It's not worth dying over. Now, there is a time. I mean, it just depends. If some guy comes up with a knife and says, "Give me your wallet," that's why I like pocket carry. Hey, man, no problem. Hold up your hands. Show him that you're complying. No problem. It's just in my, just calm down. It's just in my pocket. Now you get down on the ground right now. Make sure you got enough distance because he can move pretty quickly. But anyway, know when to fight and when to flee, because there is a time for both. Ecclesiastes 3:3-8. There's a time to comply. Some guy pulls a gun on you, it is compliance time. There is not a time to fight, you comply. Unless you are certain he's going to kill you, and then you've got to fight because that's your only chance. But if you think there's a chance, I mean a reasonable chance that he's not going to kill you, that he just wants your stuff or he just wants you out of the way while he robs the cashier or whatever, points a gun at you, comply. Ecclesiastes 3:3-5. Now, you can comply for a while, and wait your turn, and then you can launch a counterattack. Talk about that in just a second. Ecclesiastes 3:3-5. It says a time to kill and a time to heal, time to break down and a time to build up. There is a time to kill. There's also a time not to kill. Verse 8, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. There's a time to comply and to be peaceful. There's a time for war. You just got to know which is the right time. If you choose to fight, fight with all your might. You don't want to do a half-hearted fight. So if you know, that guy holds out a knife at you and he's going to come at you and you choose to fight, then you fight with everything you've got. And, you know, just do whatever you have to do to win. But if you can run, run. And run with all your might. Run as fast as you can and don't look back. If you're going to flee, flee. And there's nothing wrong with running. There is a time to flee from aggressors, depending on the circumstance. And you're not a coward for doing so. You could be a very wise man for doing so. It just depends. Jesus Christ did this in Luke 4:28-30. Luke 4:28-30. Because I've seen some of these videos where women will get attacked, and some of them just, I mean, one woman didn't even hardly put up a fight. The guy walked up behind her and kind of put her in somewhat of a chokehold and probably whispered something in her ear, and she just kind of complied and got in the car with him. That's crazy. Like, I wouldn't, if somebody tries to take you in another place, into a car, or take you to another location or something, that's when it's time to fight, and fight with all your might, because nothing good's going to happen. Something, yep, make a scream. Scream, cry. If you're a woman, it's gross. Crap on yourself. Seriously. I mean, if some guy's taking you to rape you, crap on yourself. It sounds gross, but he's probably not going to want to rape you. I mean, that's, you know, I wouldn't say that's your first recourse. I'd say pepper spray or, you know, something like that. But as a last recourse, yeah. Anyway, Luke 4:28-30. And all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath and rose up and thrust him out of the city and led him under the brow of the hill whereupon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong. And he, passing through the midst of them, went his way. He didn't fight. He fled. Right? He left. He got away. He did the same thing in John 8:59 and in Matthew 10:23. Jesus said if they were persecuted in one city, flee to another. There's nothing wrong with fleeing. And Paul did that also in Acts 14:5-6. He fled. Whenever the Jews were persecuting him, he didn't stick around to fight with them. He ran. Acts 14:5-6. And when there was an assault made, both of the Gentiles and also of the Jews, with their rulers, to use them despitefully and to stone them. This is physical violence. They were aware of it, and fled unto Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and unto the region that lieth round about. They didn't stick around to try to dodge the stones or to pick them up and throw them back. They left. They ran. Okay, number 10. Never draw your gun unless you are genuinely fearing for your life or your safety. And that's just a good rule, and that's what people will tell you in self-defense classes and concealed carry classes. Never draw your gun unless you're genuinely fearing for your life. You could provoke an aggressor by doing so. So that's a good way to get yourself into big trouble, because if some guy's just mouthing off and all of a sudden I'm going to shut him up and you draw a gun, well, maybe he's got one too. Or maybe he now fears for his life and he comes and pummels you or who knows what. So not a good idea. And furthermore, you could be arrested and put into jail for doing so. Right? You just can't draw unless you are fearing a deadly threat. You cannot draw a gun, because that is a deadly threat in and of itself. So you don't ever want to do that. Number 11. These are all, of course, my recommendations. So you don't have to do this if you don't want to. But carry your gun with a chambered round, meaning carry it loaded. Not just with a loaded clip, but with a round in the chamber. You may not have time to chamber a round in a self-defense encounter. And I've seen this on video before, where, you know, something happens really fast, and the guy's pulling out his gun, he's trying to rack the slide, and it gets jammed and everything. You're not going to have time. Carry it with a round in the chamber. And I'd say if you're not comfortable carrying a loaded gun with one in the chamber, you're not ready to carry a gun. you should be comfortable, not cocky, but comfortable carrying the gun with a round in the chamber. And if you're not ready for that, then you need more practice. But carrying one with the chamber empty is better than nothing, but it could be little better than nothing because lots of people have gotten killed doing that. Number 12, use proportionate force to end the threat. You only shoot until the threat has stopped. And you don't want to, you know, we were talking the other night and somebody said you just empty the clip on them. You're going to go to jail if you empty the clip on somebody after they're down. That is a bad, bad idea. You don't do that. You only shoot until the threat is stopped. And that may require more than one shot. If he keeps coming, you keep shooting. When he's on the ground and he's no more threat, you stop shooting. If he's on the ground and he's kind of still reaching for his gun, you could shoot again, right? But if he's on the ground, he doesn't have a gun in his hand, or if he's on the ground, he's got a knife in his hand, he's no longer a deadly threat to you, right? You stop shooting. You keep a bead on him, make sure, you know, he doesn't come back, but you just shoot until the threat is stopped. Same for police. Police don't have the right, and a good police officer, he's not going to just empty his clip. I mean, he could get in trouble for that. A lot of times they don't get in trouble for stuff, but they could. I mean, they a lot of videos I've seen, they shoot until the threat is stopped, and that's what they should do. They shouldn't keep shooting. Number 13, you can defend yourself from an attacker, but you cannot exact revenge for an attack. Remember what it says in Romans 12 and verse 19, that vengeance belongeth unto the Lord. So, you know, I've never been in a situation like that, but I suppose somebody could think, that guy just tried to kill me. I'm going to make sure he didn't try to kill anybody else. I'm going to put a bullet in his head after he's down. You cannot exact revenge. Romans 12 and verse 19, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. There was a guy in Minneapolis, just real quick story. He was a Vietnam vet, I guess, and he had these punk kids that were breaking into his house, and they'd done it numerous times, teenagers. And he kept calling the police, and they said, well, there's really nothing we can do. Install some video cameras, get them on video, and then, you know, when you have proof, then we can do something about it. And he had video and audio, and they broke into his house when he was there, and he shot one of them, and it was a girl, I think, and his gun jammed, and they have him in the audio. So, you know, he goes into a room, gets another gun, comes out, and pow, shoots her in the head and kills her. And he went to jail. And he should have. I mean, you can't do that. You can't exact revenge. Revenge is God's. You only can just stop an attacker and defend yourself. In a robbery or an assault with an armed attacker, you must wait your turn. I've seen so many of these on video. So if some guy comes into a convenience store and you're standing there, maybe you're behind the counter, you're just standing there, and he pulls out a gun, do not pull out your gun. You are going to die. You never draw on a drawn gun. That's one thing I learned from that YouTube channel, and I remember it. I will hopefully never forget it. Never draw on a drawn gun. Now, if some guy comes into the convenience store, draws a gun, starts waving around, hey, hands up, I'm no threat to you. Now he points that thing at the clerk, and you're standing off to the side, now you can draw and take out the threat. And just, you know, be careful. You're going to be accountable for where your bullets go, so you want to watch out for that, and I'll talk about that next. But never draw on a drawn gun. Even if you're an expert, you're asking to die. It's not the Wild West, right? You're not drawing to see who can shoot first or something. You're going to die. You don't want to do that. And number 15, this is the last point on this one. Beware of your backstop. Never shoot at an attacker if you have a good chance of hitting a bystander. Or really, if you have any chance of hitting a bystander. Don't shoot at an attacker because you're responsible for every bullet that leaves your gun. And this is something that I didn't really, you know, years ago, I would think, well, you know, if somebody comes in and starts shooting at the place and I pull out and I try to take him out and I end up shooting a bystander, the judge is just going to say, well, you tried. No, the judge is going to say, you're going to jail. You are responsible for that round. You can't just accidentally kill somebody trying to save other people's lives, and you're not going to be okay. So you better be darn careful when you're shooting that there's nobody behind him, and make sure you're cautious about that. Hopefully, you never have to use any of these things, Hopefully it never happens. Okay, let's talk about how gun-free zones are murder zones. According to a study done by the Crime Prevention Research Center, and I have a hyperlink there. If you get the Word document, you can click on there. It'll take you to the article, and you can read that if you want. According to this study, 98% of mass shootings from 1950 to 2018, this year, happened in gun-free zones. 98% of mass shootings happened in gun-free zones over the last, almost 70 years. Now, this study uses the following definitions of mass shootings, and I'm quoting from this article cited above. So, now, people dispute the findings because people define mass shootings in different ways. If you define a mass shooting as any time two or more people are shot with a gun, then the statistics are different. But in many shootings in cities with gangs and things like that, there's lots of times when multiple people are shot and it's not a mass shooting, right? When you get two gangs shooting at each other, that's not what you call a mass shooting, right? So here's how he defines mass shooting. The official FBI definition of mass public shootings excludes, quote, shootings that resulted from gang or drug violence or that occurred in the commission of another crime, such as robbery. The reason for this is pretty obvious. The cases and the causes and solutions for gang shootings over drug turf are dramatically different than the types of mass public shootings that we see at schools and malls, where the point of the attack is to kill as many people as possible. That makes sense, right? You would not want to include drug or gang violence or armed robbery where, you know, a few people are shot or something like that. That's not what we consider a mass public shooting. Secondly, the FBI also includes only shootings in, quote, public places, unquote, such as commercial areas like malls, stores, and other businesses, schools and colleges, open spaces, government properties, including military bases and civilian offices, houses of worship, and healthcare facilities. The reason for this is clear. For example, if the attack is in a home, the attacker is much more likely to know if a gun is owned in the home and who might have access to it. By contrast, when an attack occurs in a public place, the attackers don't know who they have to be concerned might have a gun to stop them. Now, the study also defines what a gun-free zone is. It considers a gun-free zone places where only police or military police are classified as gun-free zones. And that is actually a quote. It's not a grammatically correct sentence. I think what they meant to say is places where only police or military police have guns is considered a gun-free zone, right? So there's lots of places that would be considered, you know, places where are gun-free zones, like a school is a gun-free zone, yet there's a police officer carrying a sidearm, right? But it's still considered a gun-free zone, right? So it doesn't count if police or military have guns there. Next, places where it is illegal to carry a permitted concealed handgun are classified as gun-free zones. So if there's signs posted, no concealed carry, that's a gun-free zone. Places that are posted as not allowing permitted concealed handguns. And places where general citizens are not allowed to obtain permits. Permits are either not issued at all to citizens or to only a very tiny select segment, so-called may issue laws, usually judges, prosecutors, deputy sheriffs, or very wealthy individual. So if it's a place where most people are not permitted to carry a gun or where they won't issue permits, like, for instance, the state of Illinois, up until very recently, the whole state would be a gun-free zone because you're not allowed to conceal carry in the state of Illinois. Now you're barely allowed to. They have gotten the right, but it's quite limited. So I'd say Chicago is probably still considered a gun-free zone. And Washington, D.C., up until at least a couple of years ago, was gun-free, and so places like that. It should come as no surprise that 98% of mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. Gun-free zones only prevent law-abiding citizens from carrying guns to protect themselves. You think about it. How many criminals have ever been stopped from carrying a gun by a sign on a door or a piece of legislation, right? I mean, when's the last time you saw a guy walk up with an AK-47 and goes to walk inside of a college and he sees the no-gun sign and he says, oh, shoot, I got to go somewhere else. No mass shooting today, right? Of course not. It doesn't prevent criminals. It only prevents law-abiding citizens. And sometimes it doesn't hopefully it doesn't prevent law-abiding citizens, because a lot of times, I'll be honest with you, when I go up to a private establishment, like a grocery store, and it says no guns, I pay no attention and I walk right in. At least I did in Minnesota, because the laws there were basically they can just ask you to leave. And I do respect their private property, but I'm actually helping them out and they just don't realize it, because they're idiots for having a sign like that, because they're just asking to have a criminal come in there and shoot the place up.
The law in Missouri is that all they can do is ask you to leave. If you go back a second time with the gun, then you can be charged.
Okay. Yep. It's no wonder that mass murderers pick gun-free zones to carry out their slaughter. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, it's why wouldn't you? If I was going to try to kill as many people as possible, I would make sure I went someplace where I thought it was highly unlikely that anybody else had a gun to defend themselves. Of course. Gun-free zones accomplish the opposite of what they're intended to. They endanger people's lives, not protect them. Now, guns actually do save lives. I know the gun grabbers, they don't like this idea, and they say, oh, it's just, you know, these gun nuts are crazy because they think that, you know, a good guy with a gun is going to stop a bad guy with a gun or something, but that's actually what happens. Every year in the U.S., hundreds of thousands to millions of Americans defend themselves with a gun. And this is from a study here. I'll just give you the quote. This is actually from a Forbes article. The article was called "That Time the CDC Asked About Defensive Gun Uses." The CDC did this study and then didn't publish it, I guess. It says, in particular, a 2013 study ordered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and conducted by the National Academies Institute of Medicine and National Research Council, reported that, quote, defensive use of guns by crime victims is a common occurrence. Almost all national survey estimates indicate that defensive gun uses by victims are at least as common as offensive uses by criminals, with estimates of annual uses ranging from about 500,000 to more than 3 million in the context of about 300,000 violent crimes involving firearms in 2008. So they found that anywhere between 500,000 to 3 million people used guns to defend themselves from aggressors, at the same time that there were about 300,000 violent crimes using firearms. So at least, or more, by even if you take the low number, 500,000, more people every year use guns to defend themselves against aggressors than do aggressors use guns to try to harm people. Now, the statistics are interesting, but they're not the justification for carrying a gun to protect ourselves and others. Our God-given rights are the justification for it. The statistics are good, but that's not why I decide to defend myself with a weapon. Numerous mass shootings have been stopped by a citizen with a concealed firearm. You can see 24 such incidents in this article here. I got a link to it if you go and get the Word document. I didn't put them in there because it was long and detailed. Okay, gun control and confiscation are tools of wicked men. I want to read you some examples of what happens with governments whenever they take people's guns away. Let me just give you a biblical example first of all. Like I said, this is going to be slightly long, but I don't have nearly enough. It's not going to take very much longer because it's just some reading. Okay, first of all, you got the Philistines that enacted gun control on the Israelites whenever they conquered them. This idea of disarming a population to control them is as old as the hills. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 19. Says, now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears. So they wouldn't let them have any blacksmith in the land, because they knew what was going to happen. If they had a blacksmith, then they could take, you know, some of their tools or something and make swords or spears out of them. They wanted to disarm them so that they couldn't defend themselves. So they outlawed weapons manufacturers, basically. This is primitive times, right? But that's basically what they did, outlawed weapons manufacturers. And this was done to prevent them from rising up against their oppressors. Verse 22. So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but Saul and Jonathan, his son, was there found. So the leaders had the weapons, but the populace did not. And that was not a good thing, because whenever it came time to fight, the people didn't have weapons to fight with. Wicked men and governments had done this throughout history before they slaughtered their own people. Now, this is interesting here. I got some quotes here from an article on Snopes. Snopes is one of those debunking websites. You got to watch out with Snopes, because believe it or not, they have an agenda themselves. You know, you'd never guess that they actually have an agenda, but they do. So you got to be careful with the, you got to debunk the debunkers sometimes. But this is it quotes from a Snopes article called A Little Gun History. And they were debunking an email that was going around talking about gun history and the history of despotic governments taking the guns away from the populace before they mass murdered people. So the article says that the claims that gun control was the cause of the genocides of millions of people by totalitarian governments in the 20th century is, quote, mostly false. Now listen, this is weird. Whenever I read you the quotes from this article, this is, you're going to laugh. Because what the article says, so they have this article, A Little Gun History, and the purpose of the article is saying that genocidal governments used gun control to disarm people before they massacred them. Okay, that's what the email was saying. Now, Snopes goes through this email and says this is, quote, mostly false. So in other words, they are saying it is mostly false that governments disarm people and act with gun control and then commit genocide. This is mostly false. I think what they did is they just put mostly false because most people will just look that up, see mostly false, not read any further, and just think, nope, that's just a BS claim of those gun nuts out there. But when you actually read the Snopes article, they admit that every single one of these governments used gun control to disarm the population before they massacred millions of people. And yet they say it's mostly false. They're liars is what they are. I mean, I don't know if Snopes always lies, but they definitely lied about this one. So it goes on to confirm that all of those governments did in fact enact gun control laws and confiscate guns before they massacred their citizens, and that gun registration which led to gun confiscation played a crucial role in those genocides. So here's a quote from the Snopes article. Mass killings of civilians by military or dictatorships in the 1900s were more often than not preceded by the confiscation of firearms from targeted populations, a task made easier by laws requiring that registration and or licensing of privately owned weapons. So they say it's mostly false, and then they just flat out say that this is exactly what they did. They required registration and then confiscated the weapons and then committed genocide against their own people. And yet they say it's mostly false. Liars. I'm glad they wrote the article, though, because there's great information in there. So let me keep reading here. Here's another quote. Tens of millions of people became victims of genocide in the 20th century because they were members of groups targeted for eradication for reasons of ethnicity, religion, or ideology by ruthless military dictatorships. More often than not, these massacres were preceded by or concurrent with concerted efforts to disarm the targeted populations, a task obviously made easier by the existence of gun registration requirements. So this is why I love this article, because these people clearly hate guns, and yet they cannot help but tell the truth about all these mass killings, you know, by these totalitarian governments over the last 100 years. Here's another quote. Based on the actual evidence at hand, we find it reasonable to conclude that gun confiscations facilitated by laws requiring the registration and or licensing of firearms played a crucial role in the carrying out of 20th century genocides. How exactly do you say that claim is mostly false when you just said it's entirely true? These people are shameless. But anyway, this is great stuff. I got some quotes from that in addition to some other quotes here. So let's talk about some of these numerous examples of governments that disarmed their citizens before committing mass genocide. The first one will be Hitler in Germany. This is a quote from Adolf Hitler, supposed to be, 1942. He said the most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to allow the subject races to possess arms. These are like nations that they took over, like the Poles and places like that. History shows that all conquerors who have allowed their subject races to carry arms have prepared their own downfall by so doing. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that the supply of arms to the underdogs is a sine qua non for the overthrow of any sovereignty. So let's not have any native militia or native police. German troops alone will bear the sole responsibility for the maintenance of law and order throughout the occupied Russian territories, and a system of military strong points must be evolved to cover the entire occupied country. They recognize that if we give the Russians guns, or even their own police guns, they're going to end up turning them on us, so we got to disarm the population. Hitler was no dummy. He was evil, but he was no dummy. Here's an article from Wikipedia on their article on Nazi gun control argument. This was taken August 24th of this year. It says, few German citizens owned or were entitled to own firearms in Germany in the 1930s. The Weimar Republic had strict gun control laws. When the Third Reich gained power, some aspects of gun regulation were loosened, such as allowing ownership for Nazi Party members and the military. The laws were tightened in other ways. Nazi laws disarmed unreliable persons, especially Jews, but relaxed restrictions for quote, ordinary German citizens. The policies were later expanded to include confiscation of arms in occupied countries. So Germany started out with very strict gun control laws, then Hitler repealed some of those laws and made it so Nazi Party members could own and carry guns, but restricted the Jews and other people that they didn't like from having guns in Germany. Here's another quote from this Snopes article. Gun ownership was banned outright for all German citizens in 1919. A 1928 revision of the law lifted the ban while still requiring individuals to obtain permits to own, sell, carry, or manufacture firearms. According to Stephen Holbrook, author of Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and Enemies of the State, which was published in 2013, the Nazis used the extant law when they came to power in 1933 to revoke the permits of communists, Jews, and other, quote, undesirables, and disarm them. The first gun law actually enacted under Nazi rule, the German Weapons Act of 1938, eased some of the permit requirements, those on rifles and ammunition, though not on handguns, and lowered the legal age for the possession of firearms, but also forbade Jews specifically from manufacturing or selling arms. The regulations against Jews possessing of weapons enacted later that year, that was the regulation that was called the Regulations Against Jews Possessing of Weapons, enacted later that year, prohibited Jews from possessing or carrying any kind of weapon at all. So while the Nazis ultimately favored loosening gun restrictions on the German population as a whole, the disarmament of Jews and other targeted minority populations was an essential feature of Hitler's genocidal program, which included the murder of 6 million Jews and millions of others deemed unworthy to live under the Third Reich between 1938 and the end of World War II. And yet the same Snopes article says this is mostly false, and yet they go on to tell you how it is true. Now let's talk about Stalin, Soviet Union. It says the time period cited, 1929 to 1953, roughly coincides with dictatorship of Joseph Stalin, whose regime was responsible for the death of many millions of people, though historians disagree on the total. For a long time, 20 million was the generally accepted number, but since the fall of the Soviet Union, more documentation has become available. Quote, exact numbers may never be known with complete certainty, but the total of deaths caused by the whole range of the Soviet regime's terrors can hardly be lower than some 15 million, wrote historian Robert Conquest in his 2008 book, The Great Terror, A Reassessment, to cite one example. And then continuing in that article, it says gun registration and targeted confiscations therefore played an essential role in Stalin's genocidal activities. What did Stalin do before he killed 15 to 20 million innocent people, the bourgeois? He disarmed them. Gun registration, gun confiscation. How about Mao Zedong in China? Here's another quote. This is from Mao Zedong himself, November 6, 1938. He says, "All political power comes from the barrel of a gun. The Communist Party must command all the guns. That way, no guns can ever be used to command the party." Yeah, they know what they're doing. Here's a quote from the Snopes article again. One source, Hong Kong historian Frank Decoder, estimates that as many as 45 million people were, quote, worked, starved, or beaten to death in China between 1948 and 1952. 4 years, they killed 45 million people because they were unarmed. Here's another quote from the Snopes article. According to lethal laws, a 1912 law made it illegal to possess or import rifles, cannons, or explosives without a permit in China. So there you go, 1912, they banned people from having guns, and a generation later, they massacred 45 million people. Then we have the Ottoman Empire. This was broken up after World War I, but it used to encompass Turkey and a lot of that area there in the Middle East. This entry refers to the Armenian genocide, in which as many as 1.5 million Armenians, not Armenians, Armenians from Armenia, that's near Azerbaijan and Turkey in that area. Let me start over again. This entry refers to the Armenian genocide, in which as many as 1.5 million Armenians, then a persecuted Christian minority concentrated in the eastern provinces of the Ottoman Empire, were massacred by the Ottoman Empire. Another quote from that article. The Armenians had been officially prohibited from owning firearms for hundreds of years in the Ottoman Empire. What weapons they did have were confiscated in the interest of eradicating that part of the population. But of course, this claim is mostly false. What a bunch of nonsense. Okay, Uganda, African country. This is a Snopes article again. Ugandan dictator Idi Amin is indeed considered responsible for the massacre of at least 300,000 civilians in his own country, most of them members of Christian tribes, loyal to his predecessor, Milton Obote. Rather than being rounded up for extermination, Amin's victims were typically murdered on the spot by roving bands of soldiers. Before Obote, Uganda's gun control laws, dating from 1955, allowed the private ownership of weapons by permit only, and applications were required to prove their fitness, quote-unquote, to carry firearms. Obote's government rewrote the law in 1969, instituting a total nationwide ban on the ownership and possession of weapons, except for government officials and individuals who were granted special exemptions. Coppell reports that the law changed again in 1970 under Amin, essentially reverting to a version of the 1955 law requiring permits and proof of fitness for gun ownership, but by that time, presumably, a large percentage of the guns in private hands had already been confiscated. So the confiscated guns massacred 300 million Christians. And one more. 300,000, what did I say?
300 million.
Oh, yeah, 300,000, pardon me. One more, Cambodia, Asian country. The actual estimates, this is from the Snopes article again. The actual estimates are that between 1.5 and 3 million Cambodians, including about a half million members of ethnic minority groups, were slaughtered by the communist Khmer Rouge between 1975 and 1979. Although the dictatorship enacted no gun laws itself, there were gun control measures on the books dating from 1920 and 1938 that required the licensing of firearms and limited their ownership to hunters. According to the Small Arms Survey of the Graduate Institute of International Studies, the Khmer Rouge went about disarming the Cambodian public and arming itself via a program of gun confiscation. Quote, the Khmer Rouge regime eliminated the previous elite and in the process effectively ended private gun ownership. Memoirs of the time provide accounts of how Khmer Rouge cadres confiscated firearms along with watches, motorbikes, and foreign currencies during the first days of the takeover of power in Phnom I don't know, Phnom Penh, something. During the rule of the Khmer Rouge, all private firearms were moved from private ownership into stockpiles of the regime. And then they massacred 1.5 to 3 million people. But, of course, the claims are mostly false, don't you know? Okay, now, one more. The Second Amendment of the Constitution. Anybody that knows anything about guns is familiar with the Second Amendment. It was added to protect the people from an oppressive government, not merely to protect the rights of hunters and target shooters, right? This is what liberals always like to say, that the Second Amendment was just, you know, yeah, you can have your hunting rifle, I suppose. You can have your shotgun, but not an AR-15, but not handguns. You don't need those things. So the framers put the Second Amendment in there to protect us from the government, right? Not to let us shoot deer or something. The Second Amendment states, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, some people, they like to say, well, this is a militia, like the army. You know, the army can have the guns, but private citizens can't. I'll show you from quotes from the Founding Fathers that this is nonsense. So here I got a bunch of quotes from the Founding Fathers. This was taken from concealedcarry.com. You can click on the link there in the outline, and it'll take you to the article. This is from a letter from Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, two of the Founding Fathers, in 1787. This would have been right around the time they were writing the Constitution. He says, what country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. Jefferson wasn't about rabbit hunting. He was about protecting the citizenry from their government. Benjamin Franklin said, democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote. The Founding Fathers gave us a republic. Franklin said, whenever they came out of the Constitutional Convention, a woman asked, what kind of government have you given us, sir? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. We couldn't keep it. That's why we don't have it anymore. Not a democracy. Democracy is an evil form of government where the mob decides, the 51% mob decides what they're going to do with the 49% stuff. Okay, this is a quote from George Mason referencing advice given to the British Parliament by Pennsylvania Governor Sir William Keith, the debates in the several state conventions on the adoption of the federal constitution. He said, to disarm the people is the most effective way to enslave them. Those guys knew what they were talking about back then. This is another quote from George Mason in his address to the Virginia Ratifying Convention on June 4th, 1788. See, when you really want to understand what the Constitution means and what they intended, you read what they said in the ratifying conventions. Because they wrote the Constitution, Madison mainly, and some of the other ones, and then when they wanted to get the Constitution passed, it had to go to each of the states, and each of the states, the 13 states, had to ratify it. And they had debates whether to ratify it or not, and that's actually why we ended up with the Second Amendment, with the first 10 amendments, with the Bill of Rights, because the anti-federalists, like, I got his name right here, just Patrick Henry, and guys like that, they didn't trust the Constitution. They didn't trust these guys that wrote it. They didn't think that in the Constitution was enough to limit the government. And they demanded that the 10 amendments would be added to the Constitution before they would ratify it, to protect free speech, to protect the freedom of religion, to protect freedom of gun rights, trial by jury, all those things that are in the 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights. So anyway, when you read, if you really want to know what was intended by the Constitution, read the ratifying, the conversations that went on in the ratifying committees. And they clarified in there what they meant by these things. Anyway, so this is George Mason addressing the ratifying convention in Virginia. I ask, who are the militia? Remember, it said a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. I ask, who are the militia? They consist now of the whole people, except a few public officers. Who are the militia? The whole population. That's the militia, right? It's not the military. It's, you know, not the government. It is the people. And, I mean, you could pretty much read that right in the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The people are the militia. This is from Noah Webster, the guy that wrote the dictionary. He was also a statesman and a Christian. This is an examination of the leading principles of the federal Constitution, written 1787 when they were writing the Constitution. He said, before a standing army can rule, the people must be disarmed, as they are in almost every country in Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword because the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular troops. This is why this country is different. This is why this country has lasted as long as it has and preserved the liberties that we have for as long as we have, because this country has a tradition of gun ownership. And the government knows, in the back of their head, that they cannot run roughshod over us too much. They take incremental steps more and more all the time, but they know they can't do too much because eventually people will get ticked and heads will start to roll. This is James Madison, the father of the Constitution, in the Annals of Congress, 1789. I think that was the same year the Constitution was ratified, if I remember right. It says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. A well-regulated militia, composed of the body of the people, trained to arms, is the best and most natural defense of a free country. This is the man that wrote the Constitution. And he says, it's the people. Right, the militia is the body of the people. This is from Richard Henry Lee, Federal Farmer, number 18, 1788. A militia, when properly formed, are in fact the people themselves, and include, according to the past and general usage of the states, all men capable of bearing arms. To preserve liberty, it is essential that the whole body of the people always possess arms and be taught alike, especially when young, how to use them. Teach your kids how to shoot guns as early as you can. And this is from Patrick Henry, one of the founding fathers, one of the anti-federalists. This guy made people like Jefferson and Madison look like a bunch of liberals. Guard with jealous attention the public liberty. Suspect everyone who approaches that jewel. Unfortunately, nothing will preserve it but downright force. Whenever you give up that force, you are ruined. The great object is that every man be armed. Everyone who is able might have a gun. This is in his speech to the Virginia Ratifying Convention in 1778. So I would say, heed the wisdom of the Founding Fathers. Never give up your guns. There are a few lines in the sand that I personally have where I say they're not crossing this one. Very few, right? I mean, they can abuse me and they can take my money through taxation and they can do all kinds of other stuff. But one of my personal lines in the sand is, I will not give up my guns. I just won't. I'm not going to stand there and, you know, and stand out on my front porch with it and say, take it out of my cold, dead fingers. I'm going to try to hide. I'm going to tell them I don't have them. I'm going to, you know, not talk about it or whatever. But I will not give up my guns. Never register them. Registering them is the first step in confiscation. I was encouraged back in, it was a few years ago when the Newtown alleged shooting happened, if it actually did anyway, there in Connecticut, the school shooting, when they tried to take away the AR-15s afterwards, they tried to register them. And the vast majority of Connecticutans did not register their AR-15s, which was encouraging to me. They just said, no, we're not doing it. And then they just didn't. Good for them. If we register our guns, if we give them up, tyranny's just around the corner. Basically, as I showed you with country after country, Soviet Union, Germany, Cambodia, Uganda, Ottoman Empire, you name it, China, over and over again, when they disarm you, then they murder you. I say never, ever give up our guns.